Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, May 18th, 2022. U.S. House Democrats moving ahead with the first legislative response to last weekend's mass shooting at a supermarket in Buffalo. Many Republicans are not on board with the bill titled the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act. Homeland Security Department's Misinformation Governance Board has been put on hold just weeks after it was announced and before the board members ever met. Day after five states hold election primaries, with some races too close to call, we'll talk with political correspondent David Siders about his article. That's titled, Beware What You Wish For, Five Takeaways from a Key Primary Night. White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha holds his first briefing on the state of the pandemic and government's response. On Wall Street, the Dow drops nearly 1,200 points amid ongoing concerns about inflation. President Biden getting an update on hurricane season preparedness. The season begins June 1st. And Finland and Sweden formally ask for NATO membership. The reports are that Turkey has blocked the process for now. President Biden said he's still confident this will get done. And we start at the U.S. House of Representatives taking up a bill, as CNN writes, aimed at preventing domestic terrorism and combating the threat of violent extremism by white supremacists. The article goes on, in the wake of a horrific mass shooting over the weekend at a supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood in Buffalo, New York, that killed 10 people and wounded three others. The Justice Department is investigating the shooting as a hate crime and an act of racially motivated violent extremism. The Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act would set up offices specifically focused on domestic terrorism at the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and the FBI. The bill creates a requirement for biannual reporting on domestic terrorism threats. It also calls for assessments of the threat posed specifically by white supremacists and neo-Nazis. That reporting from CNN. Here's some of the debate on the House floor. Mary Gay Scanlon is a Democrat from Pennsylvania.
Mr. Speaker, I want to start by acknowledging the sorrow and terror inflicted upon the families and loved ones of the victims of the hateful attack in Buffalo last weekend. You know, the brutal murders that occurred in Buffalo were yet another heartbreaking landmark in the growing storm of domestic terrorism impacting communities across America, whether in Buffalo, Charleston, El Paso, or Pittsburgh. Domestic terrorists are being radicalized online, fueled by elected officials and media pundits who either embrace or wink at twisted white supremacist ideology spawned in the darkest corners of the internet and infecting our nation. Communities across America are terrified, scared to go to their supermarkets, schools, churches, mosques, and synagogues, because of the fear that the combination of lax gun laws and unchecked white supremacist conspiracies will have deadly consequences. But with this bill, we're here to say that we are one American community, and we will remain united in the face of these attacks. Where domestic terrorists aim to scare and divide our communities against each other, we must come together and condemn this hateful ideology and give law enforcement the tools to fight its most violent consequences. We are Americans. We're proud of our diversity, and we must choose community over chaos. That's why I'm proud to support the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act, and I yield back.
Congresswoman Mary Gay Scanlon, Democrat from Pennsylvania, on the House floor. Also speaking about this bill in opposition, Guy Reichenthaler, Republican from Pennsylvania.
My colleagues claim we'll prevent incidents of domestic terrorism. But let's make no mistake, Republicans are committed to fighting hatred and violence in all forms. Unfortunately, H.R. 350 does absolutely nothing to actually make our community safer. Rather, this legislation expands the federal bureaucracy. It ignores new and evolving domestic terrorist threats. And it makes it more difficult for law enforcement to recruit and retain qualified candidates. Alarmingly, it empowers Biden's DOJ to continue labeling American parents and other political opponents as threats to stifle their First Amendment rights.
Congressman Guy Reichenthaler, Republican from Pennsylvania. This bill passed the House in 2020. By voice vote, the one that's on the floor today. The sponsor, Brad Schneider, Democrat from Illinois, asking why Republicans are opposing it now. And this was Congressman Reichenthaler's answer.
The difference from 2 years ago and now is that the DOJ has started going after concerned parents that are showing up at school board meetings, labeling them domestic terrorists. The difference is that Department of Homeland Security thinks it's fitting to have a truth and disinformation board like something from an Orwellian novel. This is a different time. Also, in the last 2 years, we had $2 billion of damage that was caused by Antifa, yet my colleagues across the aisle refuse to label Antifa a domestic terrorist organization. Those are just a few of the things that have changed between now and last time we had this bill.
Congressman Guy Rushenthaler on the House floor. He mentioned the Disinformation Governance Board and the Homeland Security Department. Washington Post reporting that the department on Monday put that board on hold just weeks after it was created, and that board director Nina Jankowicz will resign, sources telling the Associated Press. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre got a question about that today.
DHS said today that they'll be pausing the Disinformation Governance Board. Did the White House play a role at all in perhaps expressing frustration on how it was rolled out, or express any involvement in how and if, whether or not it should be paused? And then also some experts have said that it was sort of set up to fail the way it was rolled out. Do you have a response to that?
So the board has never convened. The board is pausing, in the sense that it will not convene while former Secretary Chertoff and former Deputy AG Gorelick do their assessment. But the departments work across several administrations to address disinformation that threatens the security of our country is critical, and that will indeed continue. And again, neither Nina Jankowicz nor the board have anything to do with the censorship or with removing content from anywhere. Their role is to ensure that national security officials are updated on how misinformation is affecting the threat environment. She has strong credentials and a history of calling out misinformation from both the left and the right, and that's our focus.
Does the White House play a role at all in whether it should be paused or what should happen with the board?
No. First of all, like I said, this is what's happening. There is a pause. We did not have an involvement in this at all.
Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary, with reporters in the White House briefing room. From TheHill.com, Senate Republicans are resisting calls for gun reform in response to the recent mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, frustrating their colleagues across the aisle who say more action is needed in the wake of the massacre. Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming, member of the GOP leadership, said on Tuesday, "It just doesn't seem to be helpful to me to go after law-abiding citizens and our Second Amendment rights, so I'm going to continue to hold that position." And Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, said on Monday, "I think I heard a black person from Buffalo on television say that guns don't kill, people kill. So what are you going to accomplish by gun control, particularly if it's a violation of the Second Amendment?" Today, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, asked about his plans on this issue.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Schumer, will you be bringing any gun control legislation to the floor after this Buffalo shooting? And if not, why not?
Okay, I'm the author of the Brady Law, as you know, passed it in 1994 when I was a House member, and I care very, very deeply about this issue. Obviously, we want to get something done to stop gun violence. There are a number of discussions going on. Some are bipartisan, some are in our own caucus, and we're going to work towards what we can actually get done.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer with reporters on Capitol Hill. Of course, anything that is brought to the floor would need 60 votes to proceed, and that means at least 10 Republicans if all Democrats vote yes. Vice President Kamala Harris also speaking today about the mass shooting in Buffalo this past weekend. She addressed that as she spoke to the graduating cadets at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut.
"Today is a joyous occasion, but it is impossible to ignore that we gather mere days after a horrific attack of hate in Buffalo, New York. Another despicable act in the epidemic, I fear, that may be happening, of hate that we must condemn. I spoke earlier about international rules and norms, but there are also rules and norms that what we must as Americans hold on to as each other, as Americans. Rules and norms founded in the belief that a harm against any one of us is a harm against all of us. That hate and violence have no place here in America, and that we are all in this together as one nation, undivided. I look out at you cadets, and I see the very best of America.
Vice President Kamala Harris giving the commencement address at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, New London, Connecticut. She said those cadets are starting their service at a crucial moment for the world, a period in history when the rule of law is strained and fundamental principles are under threat. She specifically mentioned Russia's invasion of Ukraine. 2022 graduating class at the Coast Guard Academy is the largest in history, 252. And President Biden will be delivering a commencement speech at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, May 27th. One more note about the ongoing investigation into the mass shooting in Buffalo. New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat, launching her own investigation into the role social media companies played in connection with the shooting. The investigation will focus on Twitch, 4chan, 8chan, and Discord, but she said it won't be limited to those platforms. In a statement, she said the terror attack in Buffalo has once again revealed the depth and danger of the online forums that spread and promote hate. The fact that an individual can post detailed plans to commit such an act of hate without consequence and then stream it for the world to see is bone-chilling and unfathomable. From the Raleigh News and Observer in North Carolina, there's this: a deluge of scandals cost Congressman Madison Cawthorn his seat Tuesday as State Senator Chuck Edwards narrowly defeated the first-term incumbent for the Republican nomination in the Western North Carolina district that sent him to Congress 2 years ago. Edwards telling supporters Tuesday night that Cawthorn was gracious in defeat.
I received a call from Congressman Cawthorn just a few minutes ago. Just as I expected, he was presented himself in a very classy and humble way and offered his support to our campaign in absolutely any way that we could use him. And I'm extremely, extremely pleased that we're able to end this contest on that note.
Chuck Edwards, now North Carolina's 11th Congressional District Republican nominee on Tuesday night. In fact, Congressman Cawthorn did tweet his support for Chuck Edwards after conceding. Edwards went on to describe the agenda he'll be running on in the general election that's going to be in November.
We are going to be focused on taking the gavel away from Nancy Pelosi. And we're going to be focused on removing the teleprompter from in front of Joe Biden. And we're going to go back to work re-implementing the policies that made this country great under President Trump. We are not going to be controlled by Washington, D.C. politicians. We're going to take back our Constitution, our freedoms, and our independence. We're going to secure this nation, not only with the borders, but in the way that we handle ourselves economically and in terms of our energy independence. And we are going to create the future for our children and our grandchildren that we all enjoyed, that built this great nation.
Republican congressional nominee in North Carolina, Chuck Edwards, on Tuesday night. Today, Congressman Adam Kinzinger, Republican from Illinois, telling CNN he is glad that Congressman Madison Cawthorn lost that Republican primary to Edwards.
It's good. I mean, it's good for the country. It's good for the party. It's good for the 11th District of North Carolina. I mean, you know, look, D.C. has become kind of a growing ground for people that are just more interested in fame than governing, that are more interested in becoming famous and in actually doing really serious work at a time when, you know, we've got a lot of challenges here at home and a lot of challenges overseas. And so it was a good thing he lost at my organization, Country First, country1st.com. We've been on the ground there. We've been spending money, not on endorsing any opponent, but just getting people to turn out to the primary. This is the key, John, is people don't even vote in primaries. Primaries are, unfortunately, where like a vast majority of members of Congress are actually determined. So we think we made an impact. It's good to see him lose.
Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger on CNN. And with more on Tuesday's election primary results, not only in North Carolina, but the four other states that held them, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Idaho, and Kentucky, we're joined on the phone by David Siders, national political correspondent with Politico. Thanks for being with us. Your article at Politico.com is titled Five Takeaways from a Key Primary Night. And let's begin with the one about the defeat of Congressman Cawthorn, titled The Limits of Big Lie Politics. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think one thing I've been surprised by in the early primaries here is that Trump's big lie that the election was stolen in 2020 has not been replicated to any large degree by prominent Republicans in these primaries. And you could say that that's just because these are Republican on Republican events, but it's really not. I mean, Trump was willing in the 2016 primary to call the Iowa caucuses rigged, say he wanted a do-over against Cruz. And if you were looking for a test case to try this out, I would have thought Cawthorn might not have conceded so quickly. It was a pretty close race. Cawthorn is prone to all sorts of scandal and doesn't mind saying controversial things. But instead, he conceded. And so that was surprising to me. Of course, I think the lesson may be that this works when Trump is involved for Republicans and not necessarily for anybody else. We saw, well, just the morning after the election, Trump encouraging his Senate candidate in Pennsylvania, Oz, to declare victory, even though results in Pennsylvania are not yet final.
Another part of your article titled Trump Was Also Unelectable. What races does that refer to?
Yeah, this is a thing out of Pennsylvania where you had a lot of Democrats hoping that Doug Mastriano would prevail in the gubernatorial primary. And the idea was that he was the least electable of the bunch for Democrats to run against in November. It's probably true. And they weren't just hoping. I mean, Democrats put money into ads elevating Mastriano. But there's a real shade of how Democrats and Republicans were thinking about Trump in 2015, which, a portion of Hillary Clinton advisors back then were salivating at the prospect of running against Trump in November. And many Republicans were fearful that if Trump was nominated, the GOP would be doomed. So there is an element, I think, in Pennsylvania of careful what you wish for, that we've seen unelectable Republicans win elections before.
Part three of your five takeaways, forget party loyalty. It's all about Trump.
Yeah, you see Trump sprinkle endorsements all over the primary map, right? And largely these are endorsements to pad his win-loss record. So lots and lots of safe Republican seats where a Republican incumbent is running or somebody with only nominal or in some cases no opposition. In some big places, he has mattered. In Ohio, he clearly should take credit for the Senate result there. Same thing in North Carolina on Tuesday night. But what I think is interesting about Trump's interventions is that he's not building the party here. He's building his own brand. So his involvement in the Idaho primary did nothing except for cause a lot of upheaval in the GOP there. And I think we'll see the same thing next week in Georgia. Brian Kemp is going to prevail probably in the gubernatorial race, despite Trump interjecting himself. And I think the reason is because ultimately, if you're Trump and you're running again or thinking about running again for president, it really doesn't matter if these Republicans prevail in the midterms. It matters what kind of Republican advances. And so it's all about who's with him.
We're talking with David Siders from Politico, his five takeaways from primary night, and a fourth one, progressives have a big night.
Yeah, they clearly did. I think, you know, John Fetterman of Pennsylvania was expected to win for so long that it was easy to focus on the House contests across the country that were a lot more competitive. But the Fetterman victory is a big, big thing. I'm not sure a year ago that people would have thought that that race would be so close. And then they already had some victories elsewhere, too. You have in Oregon, Andrea Salinas winning a House race. Backed by Elizabeth Warren. There's another race in Oregon that still hasn't been called, but it's possible progressives will take down an incumbent Congress member there, Kurt Schrader. In Pennsylvania, Summer Lee is ahead. She's a progressive. So this is a pretty solid night for progressives. Talking to one of them today who said the resistance strikes back. And I think that's how they're viewing Tuesday.
And the fifth takeaway, titled "Governors Are Sticky."
Yeah, if you look at all the places where Trump has had some trouble, I mean, he pushed Mastriano. Well, he endorsed Mastriano late, so there's some debate about how much credit to give Trump in the gubernatorial race in Pennsylvania. Last week, he struggled in an open gubernatorial race with his endorsed candidate Herbster going down in Nebraska. But I'm interested in these incumbents that he's trying to take down. Brad Little in Idaho last night just thrashed Lieutenant Governor who was running against Little with Trump's endorsement. And the big one, maybe one of the biggest primaries really testing this entire Trump versus the establishment, is the primary in Georgia next week with Brian Kemp. And Kemp has been one of the top of Trump's, hit list, I think, since the election. And Kemp has really overcome that. And I think it speaks to this corner or this pocket of politics that's hard, even for somebody with Trump's profile, to get into. And that's that governors have profiles of their own. Within their states, they're often more well-known than, say, senators, definitely than Congress members or other people who the president or the former president might get involved with endorsing. And so that makes kind of an outside push, even from Trump, a lot harder to be effective.
David Sider's national political correspondent with Politico. Find his article at politico.com. Follow him on Twitter at David Siders. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. Dr. Ashish Jha, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, leading his first virtual briefing today, and the first for the response team from the White House in about 6 weeks. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the U.S. now has more than 94,000 new coronavirus infections every day. That's up 25% in a week. Hospitalizations from COVID are at about 3,000 patients per day. That's up about 18% in a week. Dr. Jha highlighting two new policy developments recently: more at-home tests available to the public, and the greater use of a drug that helps keep those infected from developing serious illness.
If you've been watching, we have launched a third round of tests that you can get from covidtests.gov. What's that about? Why are we doing that? We're doing that because the administration has put in a lot of work and resources that we had from ARP to acquire tests and make sure we had adequate number of tests. Given the spread of infections that's happening across the country, we know use of rapid tests is a very effective way of keeping infections down. If you can test yourself before you go to a large gathering, before you go visit someone vulnerable, it is an important way of reducing spread of the virus. Very good evidence that use of rapid tests can reduce the amount of infections that's happening out there. So this is one of the tools we have, one of the capabilities we have. We opened that up on Monday to a third round. We've seen really impressive demand. As of about 20 minutes ago, when we got the latest set of numbers, this opened up on Monday. About almost 8.5 million households across the country have ordered that next round of tests. We have made 8 tests available per order. The reason is in the past we were able to do 4. We've expanded that because of the testing that we've been able to obtain. We know there are multi-generational households. We know that there are households with more than four people. And we want to make sure that we make as many tests as we can possibly make available. And so that's getting out there. And I think that's going to be an important part of how we keep infections down. On the issue of how do we make sure that infections don't turn into severe illness, when I came into this job about 5-6 weeks ago, again, under Jeff Zients's leadership, the administration, I think, had done an extraordinary job of obtaining and acquiring Paxlovid and other therapeutics. And yet, 6 weeks ago, despite acquiring all that, the Paxlovid had not started really getting out there. We put in a series of steps. We made it much more widely available by letting pharmacies order directly from the federal government. We expanded tests to treat sites. There's going to be more on that coming in the days and weeks ahead. We did a big effort to connect with providers and simplify the ordering and prescription process, making sure they understood what drug-drug interactions really mattered, who was eligible. And then we talked more broadly to the media, all of us did. And what we have seen, I think, is a dramatic increase in the use of Paxlovid, about fourfold increase just in the last month. And our latest estimates are that about 20,000 prescriptions of Paxlovid are being given out every single day. I think that is actually a really important reason why, despite this very substantial increase in infections, we have not seen a commensurate increase in deaths. We have seen hospitalizations rise, but again, not as much as one would have expected at this point, despite the fact that hospitalizations do lag. When you look at ICU care, the rate of ICU hospital admissions is much lower than what one would expect with infections. And then death numbers continue to be low. Obviously, want to continue to drive that lower. But I really think that beyond the vaccinations and boosting, which are making a very big difference, I think Paxlovid is making a very big difference as well.
Dr. Ashish Jha, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, his first briefing of the team from the White House, done virtually. He was joined by two other members, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky and the White House Chief Science Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Jha also warning that without more funding from Congress, the U.S. will not be able to buy enough COVID-19 vaccines for every American who wants an updated shot later this year. There is a supplemental funding request pending before Congress. And also today, President Biden's daughter, Ashley Biden, testing positive for COVID-19 and having to cancel plans to join her mother, First Lady Jill Biden, on a trip to Latin America. White House says Ashley Biden not considered a close contact of either President Biden or the First Lady. Wall Street today, the Dow falling 1,164 points. NASDAQ down 566. S&P down 165. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, responding today to reports that Congress will be giving staff members on Capitol Hill and Capitol Police officers subscriptions to Peloton, the company that makes stationary exercise bikes and then offers online fitness classes to go with them. Washington Times writing earlier this month, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi approved a new contract between the House's administrative arm and Peloton. The new partnership allows House staff, including U.S. Capitol Police and those working far away from Washington and congressional district offices, the opportunity to receive free VIP membership on the cycling platform. Here's Congressman McCarthy.
This week, as families scramble to find baby formula, Speaker Pelosi's House decided to add special new perks for Washington lawmakers and staff. One of those perks was a VIP membership to Peloton gyms, paid for by hardworking American taxpayers. What's next? Free Jenny ice cream? You may be asking, what's Peloton? It's a bike that costs about $2,000. Not only that, each month you pay a monthly subscription fee to ride your $2,000 bike. And best of all, it's stationary. And they charge you about $300 to set it up. So it's a $2,000 bike that you pay to use and pay to set up that doesn't go anywhere. What's a business like that? Now, Speaker Pelosi decided to give everyone in Congress a Peloton gym membership. More specifically, the Premier Employees Benefits Package. And you know what? She did it without any debate or discussion with any Republicans. First, they appoint a political committee and don't allow the Republicans to name anybody. Now, they decide to use your taxpayer money with never talking to the other side. But we're left in the dark. But Congress, meaning taxpayers, will pay Peloton $10,000 up front and $10 per month per person. In all, this contract costs taxpayers an extra $100,000 or more per month. I guess New York City isn't the only place Speaker Pelosi went on a spending spree last week. As the sixth richest member of Congress, the Speaker might not be worried about this costly new program. But American families should sweat it. It comes as families are getting crushed by the worst inflation in 40 years. It is insane.
Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader on the House floor in Washington today. The Hill newspaper reporting of another, what they call perk, that's about to kick in, and that's direct-to-office alcohol delivery. They write the House's food services vendor, Sodexo, which operates house cafeterias, restaurants, and in-house catering, is now offering same-day orders for alcohol online. The sign noticed by Republicans outside the Food Service Administration in the Rayburn House office building advertised six-pack and more with drinks on demand at drinks.house.gov. President Biden warning the U.S. will likely see another tough hurricane season this year and pledging his administration is prepared to respond to the storms and help Americans recover from them. President speaking at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland, where he got a briefing from federal officials, including the head of FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, Deanne Criswell, and Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Marcia Fudge.
My message to all Americans is straightforward. We know hurricanes are coming our way. They grow more extreme every season thus far. Pay attention to the hurricane warnings and follow the guidance of your local authorities. While you do everything you can to protect yourself and your families, I promise you, we, all of us here, are going to do everything we can to protect you. Our top priority is to help Americans prevent, prepare, and respond in every community to what's going to happen. And our, you know, one of our charges one of the changes I directed is that to ensure that the piles of paperwork and a bureaucratic excuses we've been using in the past sometimes, don't stand in the way of getting help to the most disadvantaged communities as fast as possible. And I know it's not preventing, but in the aftermath, you've done an incredible job. You've done an incredible job making sure we're not leaving anybody behind. Thank you. And I've visited too many devastated areas with you, hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, etc. You do an incredible job. And that's why HUD and Marsha Fudge, Secretary of HUD, and the SBA Administrator, Isabel Guzman, briefed me today along with FEMA and Administrator Griswold. In 2021 was the third most active hurricane season ever recorded, including the first hurricane to hit the Northeast in 30 years, killing more than 100 people and causing billions of dollars in damage. And given the climate crisis, it's likely to, we expect another tough hurricane season. And storms are going to be more intense, and we're going to have shorter notice, as we saw last year with Hurricane Ida. That's why the work of these women and men is so important, and we're going to continue to ensure hurricane hunters and their partners have what they need to get their job done. It's in about red states and blue states. It's about helping communities prepare, having their back when the hurricane strikes, and being there to help. Being there to help clear the roads, rebuild the main streets so families can get back to their lives. And we don't have a moment to lose, but I want to thank the leaders and the personnel assembled here for all the work you do, and I mean that sincerely. And I look forward to hearing from you.
President Biden at Joint Base Andrews before getting that briefing on hurricane season. It officially begins June 1st. In 2021, there were 21 named storms, 7 hurricanes and 4 major hurricanes, and 8 of the 21 storms had a direct impact on the U.S. And for the 7th year in a row, forecasters are predicting an above-average Atlantic hurricane season in 2022. President Biden took a question from reporters at the end of his remarks on a different subject. They asked him about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and today's formal application by Sweden and Finland to join NATO. The ambassadors of Finland and Sweden submitted their written applications at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium. Here's the president again.
I got a call months ago from the president of Finland, wanted to come and see me. I saw him. He told me what he was thinking about, and I got a call that both the leader of Finland and Sweden are coming to see me on Thursday. I think we're going to be okay. I'm not going to Turkey, but I think we're going to be okay. Thank you.
President Biden at Joint Base Andrews. That last question about Turkey. Washington Post reports Turkey blocked the start of Finland and Sweden's accession talks to NATO on Wednesday, shortly after the Nordic nations submitted their formal applications, a signal of what could be a bumpy process to expand the alliance and reshape Europe's post-Cold War security architecture. The Post article goes on, at a meeting of NATO ambassadors, Turkey said it still needed to work through some issues related to Finland and Sweden joining the alliance. According to two officials familiar with the discussion who spoke on condition of anonymity, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has objected to Sweden's granting of asylum to members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, and he has indicated he will seek either other concessions if he is to allow the expansion to go forward. President Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan later asked about this development in the White House briefing room.
Can you talk to us about Turkey and what the administration is doing and what conversations you might be having with Turkey about their plans to block Finland and Sweden's applications? Is there a deal to be struck with Turkey?
We're confident that at the end of the day, Finland and Sweden will have an effective and efficient accession process, that Turkey's concerns can be addressed. Finland and Sweden are working directly with Turkey to do this, but we're also talking to the Turks to try to help facilitate. I spoke with my counterpart today. Secretary Blinken is meeting with his counterpart, perhaps as we speak, in New York. And we feel very good about where this will track to. And President Biden will express that confidence, as we believe the President of Finland and Prime Minister of Sweden will express that confidence tomorrow.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the White House briefing room, referring to the leaders of Sweden and Finland coming to the White House to meet with President Biden on Thursday. Jake Sullivan also talking about President Biden's first trip to Asia as president. He leaves Thursday, visiting Japan, and then going on to South Korea. Well, before the NATO talks to admit Finland and Sweden came to a halt today due to Turkey's objections, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg formally receiving the written request from those countries' ambassadors at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium.
Ambassadors, dear Klaus, dear Axel, dear friends, good morning. This is a good day at a critical moment for our security. Thank you so much for handing over the applications for Finland's and Sweden's membership in NATO. Every nation has the right to choose its own path. You have both made your choice after thorough democratic processes. And I warmly welcome the requests by Finland and Sweden to join NATO. You are our closest partners, and your membership in NATO would increase our shared security. The applications you have made today are an historic step. Allies will now consider the next steps on their path to NATO. The security interests of all allies have to be taken into account, and we are determined to work through all issues and reach rapid conclusions. Over the past few days, we have seen numerous statements by allies committing to Finland and Sweden's security. NATO is already vigilant in the Baltic Sea region, and NATO and allies' forces will continue to adapt as necessary. All allies agree on the importance of NATO enlargement. We all agree that we must stand together, and we all agree that this is an historic moment which we must seize. So thank you. It's great to see you both.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at NATO headquarters in Brussels with the ambassadors to NATO from Finland and Sweden. NATO, or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, began in 1949 with 12 countries, and since then 18 more have joined. The last expansion was in 2017 when Montenegro was added. Some headlines today from Russia's war in Ukraine. U.S. Embassy in Kyiv reopening after a three-month closure. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky submitting a bill to Ukraine's parliament to extend martial law and military conscription by three more months. Russia says almost 1,000 Ukrainian fighters who had held out inside that steel plant in Mariupol have surrendered, but their fate is uncertain. Some reports are that some may be transported back to Russia to face war crimes charges. And a 21-year-old Russian soldier facing the first war crimes trial since Russia's invasion has pleaded guilty in Ukrainian court to killing an unarmed civilian. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more of Washington's top stories delivered to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. You can go to c-span.org/connect to sign up. Hope you have a good night.